entire year through the Haftorah portions. They are the word Haftorah means concluding. It is the concluding reading to the Torah portions. We read through, every synagogue in the world reads through the Torah on the same day. They're on the same page. Every synagogue in the world is reading Leviticus today. And every synagogue in the world is reading Jeremiah 16. And we are part of that reading and joining in that great tradition. And we are reading these portions. They tend to be short, about 20 verses or so. And they, not always, but usually reflect somehow on the Torah reading. This week's Torah reading was the blessings and the curses. You will be blessed if you obey, and you will not if you don't obey. God will pursue you and eat and send you into exile. But even in exile, God will reach out to you. Last week, I talked about how basically the theme, there are two big broad brush themes of the prophets. Here it is. The prophets say to the people one of two things. Either you are walking down a very dangerous path. Don't you recognize how dangerous it is? You are going to end up being disciplined by the Most High if you keep on this path. That is announcing them and showing them the error of their ways. Or the other is this. Because you have erred in your ways and been sent into exile, which is the end result of those blessings and curses, the curses, that is, because you have been sent into exile, God says, I still remember you, and I'm still going to draw you back. There I will send my rescue. There I will send my salvation. Because you have been sent into exile, I'll create this new covenant that I'm going to establish with you. In Jeremiah, in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, the promises of the new covenant that Messiah, for us as Messianic believers, that Messiah has brought us, only was established because the people of Israel went into exile. Promises, you can only be rescued if you're in exile. And the people were sent into exile, and so God said, you broke the covenant, but as Rod beautifully pointed out, God says, I remember my covenant, and I'm going to take action to maintain my relationship with you, whatever it takes. And so God says, I'm going to create a way to rescue you, redeem you, deliver you, free you. I'm going to give you a new Passover. And this is the language, for instance, that comes up in the book of Isaiah. New Passover, new Exodus from Egypt. You're going to come out of, it's not going to be like the kind of deliverance from Egypt that you experienced, but you're going to come home once again. It's almost like a country song. Strike that from the record, by the way. So one of two messages. And so people have often told me that more than once that they find the reading the prophets, well, it's intense. It's like I can't understand it. The prophets are using really dramatic language to say one of those two things. Don't keep going where you're going, or now that you've fallen over, here's what God will do to stand you up once again. Sometimes those messages are linked together. And this week is one of those examples. Jeremiah chapter 16, verse 19 begins the reading. O Lord, my strength and my stronghold, my refuge in the day of affliction. Unto you, to you, all the nations will come. Not speaking here of the Jewish people of Israel, but speaking of the nations. Lord, to you, all the nations will come from the ends of the earth, and they will say, again speaking of the nations, the prophet looking forward to what the rabbis say will occur in the messianic times, all the nations will come and say, our fathers have inherited nothing but lies. It's interesting that that word there for lies is sheker. I wish I had my dry erase board with me, because I'd write sheker on the board. It's shin kof resh. Shin kof resh. And if you know those letters, you know that all those letters have they stand on one foot. A kof stands on one line. Not like a bet, which has a nice base. It rests like the letter D. It has it sits on something. But an F, for instance, in English, is just a line, and it can fall over. An F can fall over, whereas a capital letter A, has 2 feet, and it rests securely. In the same way, the Hebrew word for lie or false, each one of the three letters has one line of the Hebrew letter. And because of that, because it looks unsteady, the word itself looks unsteady, Jewish tradition teaches us that lies are never secure. They never stand solid. They always stand on one foot. Lies will eventually fall over. I can't do it that long. So the nations say, our fathers have inherited nothing but lies, things that are vain, where there is no profit. Shall a man make gods for himself that are no gods? Behold, therefore, verse 21, I will cause them to know. This once I will teach them my hand and my might, and they will know that my name is the Lord. The nations will be taught by the Lord. They will know my name. They will know who God is. They will know God's character, God's compassion, His identity. But contrast that with the opening verses of chapter 17. The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron, with a point of a diamond. Some translations say flint. That word can also be translated diamond. I remember from geology class with a teacher, is a brand new teacher out of college that was my geology teacher in eighth grade. I learned that diamonds were the hardest of all rocks. If you really wanted to carve something, you'd use a diamond. I don't know why anyone would want to do such a thing to a diamond, but I guess the diamond wouldn't be damaged. God says Judah's sin is engraved with a diamond, indelible, with an iron pen. And it is engraved on the tablet of their heart and on the horns of your altars. Later in Jeremiah chapter 31, the prophet says that the time will come where God will write His commands on your heart. It's the promise of the new covenant. God will write His commands on your heart. Contrast that with what it says here, where your sin is written, engraved, plowed on your heart, on the tablets of your heart. So Jeremiah is presenting us with a choice. We can have one of two things engraved on our heart, either God's instruction or our sin. The prophet goes on to talk about how they have established their idols, their Asherah poles. One of the main cultic traditions in the first temple period, in the generations after David and Solomon, was the were idolatrous practices to a goddess, actually, named Asherah. And one of the ways that this goddess was represented was with a pole. We're told that Israel, earlier in Jeremiah, that on every hill and under every leafy tree, they would worship their idols. To me, that's mind-blowing. I can only take that language as hyperbole, that under every hill, on every hill and under every tree, this is what they would do. But I can't take that as literal language. It's just too nasty. So you understand what it means that Jeremiah is writing to Israel saying, Your sin is so engraved on your hearts. I find it interesting to contrast that with the opening where it talks about how the nations will come. The nations will say, we give up our gods. We will pursue and be taught by the God of Israel. But yet it is Israel, the Jews themselves, that are contrasted, and they have the hard hearts. Judah should be the one who is winning the prize, but yet as Jeremiah presents it as the nations are the one that's winning the prize. Interestingly, Paul picks up that very concept in the book of Romans chapter 9 and 10. Israel has stumbled while the nations have entered into the promises of God. And so, verse 5, this is what the Lord says. Cursed is the one who trusts in man, who makes flesh their strength, whose heart departs from the Lord. Cursed. We read the blessings and the curses in this week's Haftorah portion, in this week's Torah portion. The blessings and the curses. Cursed is the one who makes their own resources their trust. Couple things. Who was the first person that God ever cursed because of their sin? Oh, I hear different responses. You're right. It's not. Yeah, you're right. You should have stuck with your first answer. God never. Read the account closely. God cursed with the sin of Adam and Eve. God cursed the ground, but He did not curse Adam. He cursed and made work more difficult. Cain was the first person cursed because of their sin. Genesis chapter 4, it was because Cain had a flagrant rebellion that not even Adam dared. Adam made excuses. Adam did all kinds of stuff when he sinned. But he didn't have flagrant rebellion against God. Cain, however, did. God, in fact, pursued Cain, and Cain wouldn't even talk to God. if you read closely. So Cain had a different heart. Jeremiah says, cursed is the one who trusts in man. It's interesting that in that verse where it says, cursed is the one who trusts, or cursed is the person who trusts, the Hebrew word there is not the regular word for man. It doesn't say cursed is the ish who trusts in man. It's cursed is the gever. Gever. Does anybody know what gever actually means? We read in our Amidah, that prayer where we all stood up and prayed together in Hebrew. We called God the great, mighty, and awesome God, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vahanora, Gibor. Isaiah calls God El Gibor, the one promised in Isaiah chapter 9, I think. El Gibor, the mighty God. Gibor means might, strength. Gever is the noun related to the adjective Gibor. Thanks for sticking with me for the Hebrew lesson. My point is this. When it says cursed is the gever, it's more than just cursed is the person that doesn't trust the Lord. It's cursed is the person that is strong, the mighty one, the strong one, the resourceful one, the one that has political alliances or endless possibilities or endless ideas or bottomless wealth. Self-reliance. I think self-reliance is one of the world's most penetrating faults right now. Oh, we don't have Asherah poles, but we don't trust the Lord. We're self-sufficient in ourselves. We think we're a mighty person. We're a gever. Cursed is the gever, the one who trusts not in the Lord, whose heart departs from the Lord. And then listen to this poetic description. He will be like a tree in the desert. One of the commentators described this as a dwarf juniper tree, a stubby, scrubby little guy out in the desert. It says, he will be like a tree in the desert that will not see good when it comes, but will inhabit the parched places in the wilderness, a sulfurous land that isn't inhabited. I once, when I played in a band when I was in college, we played for a kids camp that had us come play. In fact, they put us to work as counselors for the week. But the whole town just stunk. It smelled like eggs, bad eggs, and the sulfur place. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, the man who doesn't trust in the Lord will be like a stubby little tree out in the desert. It will be in a place that's sulfurous, a place that's uninhabited. And if you've ever been to one of those places, you wouldn't want to be there either. That uninhabited place. In other words, alone, abandoned. Who is unable to see good when it comes. Think about that. When you trust in yourself, when you trust in your own resources, when you're self-sufficient, it blinds you. You're not able to see goodness when it comes. Contrast that with verse 7 and 8. Blessed is the gever, same word. Blessed is the person that trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord. For he will be like a tree planted by the waters that spreads out roots by the river. It will not see heat when it comes, but its foliage will be luxuriant. What this translation says. Luxuriant. Fresh. Green. It will not be anxious in the year of drought, neither will it ever stop yielding fruit. This is beautiful. Blessed is the gever. It's okay to be a gever. It's okay to be mighty. It's okay to be strong. It's okay to be wise. It's okay to be rich. As long as you understand those things. As long as they, we're told elsewhere in Jeremiah, as long as they are not the things you boast in. The wise man is not to boast in his wisdom. The rich man is not to boast in his riches. The wise man is not to boast in his wisdom. The ingenious person is not to boast in their ingenuity and their resourcefulness. Those things are not wrong, but so much they become our self-sufficiency, the thing we stand on. Blessed is the sufficient, strong Jever, the strong one, whose trust is in the Lord. You're going to be like a tree too. In this case, you're not going to be a tree out in an uninhabited place, alone. You're going to be a tree that grows up with roots by the water. But you won't see something either. You won't see something also. The person who doesn't trust the Lord will not be able to see good. But the person who does trust the Lord will not be able to see heat and drought when it comes. Doesn't mean it's not there. I know summertime in Israel is really dry and it's really hot. But when you have your roots planted along the river, not just the wadi, an occasional riverbed that flows when it rains, we have those in our yards, right? It rains, we suddenly have a river. But that kind of river is not the kind of river we're talking about, a river that flows. It won't see heat when it comes. Its leaves are always green. They always give off an odor. By the way, Paul picks up on that in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 about what kind of odor we give off. I'll let you check that out on your own. Whose leaves will always be with lots of odor and will not be anxious or worry. Worry is the opposite of trusting in the Lord. Worry is probably the feeling that I'm not a gever, I'm not resourceful, or I don't have unlimited resources, I don't know what I'm going to do, I'm not strong, I'm not mighty. I'm not trusting in myself because I don't have anything in myself. But then the fear sets in, the worry, the anxiety. Because I'm not strong. I don't have resources. I don't know where to turn. It's the same thing going on. Rich people cannot trust. Rich people are able to not trust the Lord. Resourceful people are able to not trust the Lord. But people that don't have resources are also able to not trust the Lord. Does that make sense? So don't get confused and think that there's something spiritual about, you know, being rich or poor or rich or strong or weak. People without are just as able to not trust the Lord, and it demonstrates in our anxiety, in our worry, our fear. The person who trusts the Lord will not be anxious in a year of drought, but they will keep bearing fruit. Bearing fruit. Yeshua, Messiah, told us that if you remain in me and I remain in you, you will bear much fruit. In other words, it's not about what you're plugged into except Yeshua. If you are plugged into me and my life is flowing through you, you will bear much fruit. We must be plugged into Messiah. Messiah is our power station. Messiah is our resource. Then we come to that verse that Rod mentioned in verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and exceedingly weak. Who can know it? It's interesting to me that the key, another Hebrew lesson, by the way. What is the name of Jacob in Hebrew? Yaakov. Yaakov. And what does Yaakov mean in Hebrew besides Jacob? Supplanter, trickster, deceiver. Deceiver, trickster, like you said. The word here in this verse where it says the heart is deceitful is the root word of the name Jacob. The heart. Your heart is Jacob. Your heart is deceitful. I think Jeremiah is being very specific in his language here. They're going to read that word and see the name Jacob. Your heart is like Jacob. And it's exceedingly weak. So very human. So very Jacob-like. I think one way to think of this is, what is our heart like? Do we trust the Lord? Are we one that does not trust the Lord? But then even when we answer that question, we just read that the heart can deceive us. The answer comes in verse 10. The Lord knows the heart. God searches the heart to give to every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doing. Again, the idea of fruit comes up. Be planted by the river. You will bear fruit. Unless you bear fruit, we're told, your trust is questionable. Bearing fruit, not worrying, is the symbol of trust in God. It's not what we say with our lips. It's not where we go at a particular time every week, on the weekend, on a Saturday morning, or even a Sunday morning. Do we bear fruit? What is our fruit? What's our fear level? Are we anxious? What kind of tree are you? And where are you planted? The last verse of the Torah portion the Haftorah portion, is in verse 14. And this is Jeremiah speaking. Up to now, God has actually been speaking. Jeremiah giving us God's statements. But Jeremiah speaks in verse 14. It's actually the beginning of a prayer that lasts for several verses. But the portion ends with the first verse of his prayer. It says, "Heal me, O Lord, and I will be healed. Save me, and I will be saved. For you are my trust. You are my praise." This verse shows up in the liturgy, the weekday, not the Sabbath, but the weekday liturgy of the Amidah, that prayer we say when we stand up. If you think it's long now, wait till we pray it sometime on a weekday. It's a lot longer. But one of the statements in that prayer during the week is a quote from this verse. "God, heal me. God, heal my heart. Heal me. Allow me to trust you. God, make me a tree that's planted by the water. God, don't allow me to be a tree out there alone in a parched, desolate, uninhabited, sulfur-smelling place." God, allow me to smell good. Don't let me smell like sulfur. God, let me smell luxuriant. Let my leaves give off a good odor. God, heal me, and I'll be healed. Save me, and I'll be saved. For you are my praise. Ki tehilati ata. Steve McConnell sings that song on that disc you have. Ki tehilati ata. You are the one I praise. It takes us back to the beginning of the Haftorah portion. Remember where it started? It was talking about idols and Asherah poles and their idolatry. What drew their worship? What drew their praise? Jeremiah says, "Heal me so I can praise you." This passage is about our heart. Sins are engraved on hearts. The heart is so very human, like Jacob. But the cry is, "God, heal my heart so you will be my praise."